Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM.
Hello, and welcome to Anchorage Edition, where each week local reporters and journalists get together to discuss the topics in the news affecting Anchorage and Alaska. I'm your host today, Lori Townsend, and joining me is Richard Maurer, investigative reporter with the Anchorage Daily News, and Matthew Felling, who is an anchor reporter with KTVA Channel 11 here in town. So thanks for being here, both of you. Let's get right into this. It would be hard to have a discussion about Alaska news this week without mentioning the U.S. Senate campaign. Joe Miller's security team arrests Alaska Dispatch editor Tony Hopfinger at a town hall meeting last weekend. Richard, you were there, and it seems nearly got cuffed yourself. Kind of lay it out for us.
I was there. I missed the part where he actually was arrested, and it's officially called an arrest. It's like a citizen's arrest. It's a private person's arrest in state statute. And I was with a photographer from the Daily News, Bill Roth, and he said, "Tony Hopfinger just got arrested." No, yeah, right. And so I finished doing what I was doing in the hall. The thing had just ended. And I walked back, said, "Well, maybe, you know, maybe this is true." And I walk into the hallway, and there's Tony sitting in a little chair, his arms behind his back, and this one guy, a military-looking guy, standing over him. And I said, "Tony, are you in handcuffs?" And he said, "Yeah, come talk to me. I want to tell you my story." I said, "Okay, whatever." So luckily, I had my video camera in my pocket. I usually don't carry one. And walked up to him and started telling me. It took me a minute to remember how to turn the thing on. And just started talking. And he says, "I tried to talk to Joe Miller. There was some pushing. Next thing I know, my hands behind my back. This guy puts me in handcuffs." And all of a sudden, right then, these bunch of other security guards come walking down the hall. "You get away from him! You're trespassing. Leave this place immediately." I said, "No. This is a public school. This is a public event. I'm a reporter. I'm not leaving." And just things went downhill from there.
Yes, escalated or deteriorated from there, depending on how you'd want to term it.
Yeah, we had the shot heard around the world back in the 1700s, and we had the Bobby Thompson home run. Rich Maurer had the shot seen around the world. I mean, if his video hadn't been part of that story, it probably wouldn't have gained the traction it did. I reported on it. I used your video. It went CBS National overnight. And I think this is one of those stories that's like an onion. The more you peel away at it, the more you just want to start crying. I mean, you were saying it's a public event. It's a public school. And on what grounds would anybody need to bring out handcuffs? On what grounds would they actually say that he violated? It turned out to be an assault that turned out to not be validated by the APD. And this security firm that he brought in, it turns out that the Anchorage School District says that, yes, the Miller campaign needed a security plan. But that's just, you know, you could have a den mother at a Boy Scout meeting. You could have somebody just watching the door, making sure that nobody bangs into a locker. They certainly didn't need these guards from drop zone security. And there's a lot of onion peeling that has to be done with drop zone security as well. But we probably don't have time to go there.
Well, the interesting thing is that they did have a permit that said they are leasing for the night this part of the school building. Now, we've had other candidates hold town hall, similar town halls around the city in schools. And I don't know of other times that there's been an actual security team there. So it's interesting that Mr. Miller decides to use an actual security force. I'm not sure what's going on there. Has anyone had a chance to talk to him about that?
I actually got a chance to talk to him on Monday. And I said, "Listen, on primary night, you've got a coterie of guards. I don't think they were armed. And then at this town hall meeting, you have these gentlemen in suits who apparently were active duty military, which is a whole other onion to peel." And I said, "Listen, what makes you bring security into this? Why are you doing this? What sets you apart from Governor Parnell, from Senator Murkowski, from Senator..." Like, I've never met a politician in Alaska who walks around with guards like this. And he said, "We've only brought him on, this will be the second time or the first time." And I'm not sure that that matches up with what I've seen in terms of the bordering on military presence around him. I mean, there's been plenty of times that I've talked to him that they weren't there, but I think of a lot of public events, he brings them in.
Well, famously, at the I wasn't at the 2008 Republican convention, but that's the one where he attempted to oust Randy Riedrich as the chairman of the Republican Party. Famously, people who were attending that event said he was surrounded by people with little earbuds and basically a phalanx of security. So, I mean, this seems to be what he does, what he either seems to need, or maybe it's part of an image. I don't know. Certainly, there was no one physically threatening him at this event that I could see, and I don't know that there has been. But 2 days later, I went to Soldotna at an event, very similar event at the sports center there, and there was no security. And I asked him, said, "Well," he said, "it was in the we had to do it according to the school district contract," and that's just not true. But Soldotna was also a loving crowd. I mean, he had two standing ovations, and clearly he was. There was none of the kind of sharp questioning that he received by some of the people in Anchorage as well.
Well, it seems as if the issue is done now. The city prosecutor's not going to file any charges against either Drop Zone security members or Tony Hotfinger for his alleged trespassing. But not to beleaguer the point too much, but there was also an issue that came up the week before in which a Fox Channel personality was here and interviewed Mr. Miller, and then he refused immediately following that to answer Alaska media questions, and that's sort of been the standard that was set then. Yeah, have you had a chance to talk to him since that time?
The spotlight has definitely been cast, I mean, nationally as well as here, about Joe Miller's relationship with the Alaska media. There was a reporter who called me the other day and said, what is your relationship with Joe Miller where you actually get to talk to him? And I didn't realize that I had extra access. I've spoken to him 3 times, I believe, ever. But by dint of me talking to him on Monday, I guess I was the only Alaska reporter to talk to him this past week. His approach is very odd, not only in that he's doing a lot more national than he's doing local, but he's saying, it would be unfair to say he's saying two different things, but he has two different approaches. On CNN's John King, on Monday, John King says, "What of this Fairbanks North Star Borough issue?" And Miller talks to him, and he elaborates further than he ever has with anybody in the Alaska media. So after he does CNN, he comes over to talk to me. And I've got the transcript of CNN where he's saying this incident to Mr. King at CNN. And I say, "Listen, you said right here that you did this during your lunch hour, so it really wasn't on borough time. What can you elaborate on this? Because I know that you want this story to go away, and it's not going to go away until you elaborate." And he said, "I've told you what I'm going to tell you. I was never fired. I was never threatened with being fired." And I said, "Go further with me. You went further with John King," and he wasn't going to.
Well, and the thing is, it might be a strategy. I don't know. I can't look inside his head. But when John King is not as familiar with the specifics of the event as you or I or any Alaska reporter would be, so John King may not have the follow-up question to ask. Well, okay, so you weren't fired over that incident. Of course, we know he wasn't fired over that incident. Mm-hmm. Well, what else happened? And I think you may have been trying to get at that. I certainly would have tried to get at that, but we don't have the opportunity to talk to him. And I think the open letter that the Republican Party leaders, most of them probably Lisa Murkowski supporters, but I don't see why that diminishes the content of that letter.
It is quite strongly worded.
It's very strongly worded, and it said, "Joe Miller, please answer to Alaskans, answer to the Alaska media. There are questions about your character. There are questions about your background. Those are unresolved." And that's all I'm trying to do. I have no pony in this race. I'm just a reporter. I'm just trying to find out, and I've never seen anything quite like this. I mean, we've come across times when I'm not going to talk to the press, and Ted Stevens has certainly had those moments. Frank Murkowski had those moments. I mean, they all do.
Sure.
Don Young, I probably would, but you get over them, and because we have a role. I mean, we are representing the we ask the questions that Alaskans would probably want to ask themselves. I mean, I get emails from you. Ask them this. Ask them that. Well, I would if I could, but that's what we're trying to do. We're just trying to get at some basic facts. We're not trying to get his medical records. We're not asking him about very private personal issues. No, not at all. We're asking about his job performances in previous jobs. We're asking about what you would think that even the Tea Party people who criticize me, they'd want to know that the things Joe Miller says today are things that he will carry through if he is elected. I heard someone was saying, well, let's throw all the bums out. If he's elected, you're going to, throw him out again in 6 years if he doesn't do what he says he's going to do? I mean, that's why character is so important. What are they going to do when they're in office?
And I think my final point on this is that there are candidates out there that seem to be sort of wearing this as a badge of honor that they're not going to speak to the media, which, of course, as someone in this profession, it troubles me greatly because I think that there's not enough understanding of exactly what you were just speaking about, of what our role is, that we're sort of the voice of people that can't get that access to ask those questions but want them answered. And so,
and I think we're not going personal. We're not going medical. We're not going relationships he's had in the past. We're going into his stances on the Constitution, his stances that he says in town hall meetings about like repealing the 17th Amendment and whatnot, and the founders. And if he has these positions, you ask him to defend his positions, and then you ask him about his record, which may not be in line with those positions, getting rid of unemployment, getting rid of these sort of things. I think that it's on the table, and when he said the thing about personal and background, I didn't understand. I mean, look at his commercial. It has to do with his military, his previous military history. It has to do with him being a magistrate in Tok. You run on it, and then you have to answer about it, too. It's part of, it's simple vetting.
Absolutely.
And it's not like the campaign should know that when we write our profile of candidate Joe Miller, we're going to say what he didn't answer. We're not going to have the answers, but we're certain readers are going to have the questions and they could evaluate it on their own.
Well, this is a very interesting topic for so many reasons because of all the other implications that surround it. And I'm sure we'll be coming back to these issues in the next 2 weeks as we lead up to the November 2nd election.
One last thing.
Sure.
I do feel bad as a media. It's not a mea culpa. It's just all the oxygen's been sucked out of the room. We did a story on Wednesday talking about the other races that people haven't gotten a chance to think about. We sat down with Janet Reiser, and Janet Reiser, she says, she was completely unrehearsed because she said, I've never talked to the media. This is my first interaction with a reporter. And I just said, wow, there's got to be a way that we can cover the day-to-day Miller-Murkowski-McAdams race. We've actually started just putting it in the margin. Here's what happened, bing, bang, boom, like at SportsCenter. And then we go to the meat of Harry Crawford's out there, Janet Reiser's out there, here's Gabrielle Ledoux. And we're trying to, I think today we're doing a story about judges and propositions. We're just trying to... We're going to talk about it, but there's a lot heftier things that we still have to address as well.
Absolutely. So some balance is important in all those issues. Well, the AFN convention, the Alaska Federation of Natives convention, is going on in Fairbanks right now. And they had, I guess we're still on the Senate candidates for
Surprise.
A bit here, but they had canceled a scheduled Senate debate. And AFN has come out now and endorsed Lisa Murkowski, something that doesn't happen all the time. They don't always endorse a candidate. And there's quite a bit of controversy surrounding this Alaskan Standing Together organization that has put money into supportive ads for Senator Murkowski. Matthew, what do you take away from this?
Well, this all goes back to the ruling in January or February, Citizens United, where the Supreme Court said... we're going to let the money come back into political campaigning. And we're going to make it, they probably didn't recommend this, but it became a political animal that you could have independent expenditures where any amount of money from any private group can be directed to a information campaign that is not in line, that doesn't have any communications with the candidate, which is controversial enough, and that's what the issue was with Alaskan Standing Together. That's what we're seeing with Tea Party Express. That's what we're seeing with Alaskan Standing Together. There are no rules anymore. And they're allowing these ads to go out. And Joe Miller, they even used the I'm not going to answer any questions about my previous history. Alaska Standing Together did that. And I think the Federation of Natives, it didn't surprise anybody at this table. It didn't surprise a whole lot of people that they would have swung so far in support of Senator Murkowski because of her experience. And also their concerns about earmarks and funding to rural Alaska. But there's starting to be a little bit of pushback with her relationship with them, too. They mentioned her by name and in one of their online bits of information, which I think is one of those things that you just cannot do, even with Citizens United. That's one of the delineations that you're not allowed to do. And the Joe Miller campaign seized on that and said, "Listen, this cannot be so." And they tried to make something of it. And they got some coverage out of it yesterday at the initial day.
Well, there's a lot at stake here because of the 8A program that Senator Murkowski's been very supportive of, and I think that. Joe Miller has been critical of the 8A contracting provisions that are in place for Alaska Native corporations. Scott McAdams has been supportive of some aspects of it. I'm not real clear on what his record is on that.
He has said point blank, "I'm all for 8A." You know, end of story. I think the politics of this are real fascinating too, because what Lisa Murkowski is trying to do is prevent as many Native votes as she possibly can from going to Scott McAdams. Any Native vote that is not for Lisa Murkowski is a vote for Scott McAdams. Joe Miller's not going to get very many Native votes. So to get elected, she needs lots of Democratic votes. And as long as Scott McAdams is running a credible campaign, it would be very difficult for her to win the write-in campaign. She not only needs the vast majority of moderate voters to fill in the oval, she needs Democrats, people who would naturally vote for Scott McAdams, including many, many, many Natives in the bush.
And that was the criticism about canceling the debate, was some folks at AFN expressed disappointment because they said it seems as if AFN leadership is trying to limit our access to the other candidates, to Joe Miller and Scott McAdams in particular.
I was at the Native Summit a few weeks back, and they asked the question point blank, what are we going to do? How do we move forward with the Native 8A contracts? And McAdams said, "They're fine. Don't touch them. Leave them alone. The system's working." Murkowski took that centrist position of, "There's some abuse. There's some oversight that is needed. We need to tweak it and perfect this, but I like it." And Miller came out and said there needs to be some really strong reform. There needs to be, I don't think he used the word overhaul, but it was clear that he really wanted to take it on because and he sounded a lot like Claire McCaskill from Missouri, who really wants to take a look at this. I actually got a chance to talk to the McCaskill office yesterday because AFN President Julie Kitka said, "Listen, we are good with a little tweak here and there, but we're not gonna go under the chopping block altogether." So when it comes to the 8As, I think what the 8A position was yesterday was also definitely in line with Murkowski's position.
And some of the ANCs, the Alaska Native Corporations, have come forward with proposed changes themselves to try to meet Senator McCaskill halfway, I think, or maybe more than halfway, they're hoping, so that they can help craft some of these changes, because I think they realize they are going to come and they want to be involved in that. Well, there are a lot of other issues, and this is Anchorage Edition, so let's get to some South Central things. The Fire Island Wind Farm proposal that CIRI, Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, is proposing. Four utilities are trying to get power purchase agreements. It's sort of kind of like a green energy open season, it seems. And the talks aren't moving very quickly. What's known about that?
Well, I think originally the CIRI people told the legislature in March that they would hope to have this thing built and ready to go, 36 towers pumping out electricity in 2011. That slipped back to 2012 at the earliest. It's signing these contracts with the utility as part of it. It has to be done by November in order to keep a federal grant that's part of this. But you know, you got to. This is important because, again, it goes to the whole question of how much power is there in cooking. Right now, everything's coming from natural gas, and there are, we know about the problems with natural gas. There's still supply, but there's not enough capacity, so that that over the course of a year, there's enough natural gas to meet the needs for heating and power generation. But on any given cold day in winter, it may be tough to get the gas into the pipe at that time. So anything that you can take that doesn't use that gas, such as wind turbines, is a benefit. But I was just in Portugal, the whole eastern part of the country is mountainous, and practically every ridge was just lined with wind turbines, and you just don't see that in this country, especially you don't see it in Alaska. You just wonder why are other countries so much faster on this than we are?
Well, Americans have towers too in just about every area. They're called cell phone towers, which tells you where our priorities are in terms of wind versus I need to be able to call up and see if we need peanut butter at the grocery store at any given moment.
Excuse me, I got to text someone.
Yeah, exactly. LOL, Rich Maurer. I want to look at the math on the wind turbine, on the Fire Island project. We got $40 million. Asterisk to the viewers, that was stimulus money. I think it's hard to find examples of things that are actually tangible stimulus projects, and there is one of the shovel-ready, or apparently not, projects that was out there. But when Bill Popp talked about it earlier this week, he said, listen, it would defray 3% of the energy consumption. And I just wonder, Portugal probably has sunk the cost. And I know that we have to do an upfront cost when it comes to building these power lines for the future. But $40 million and then some, $40 million is probably just the beginning with regards to a grant. For 3%, it's a little bit more of a tough sell.
How do the subsidies match up, though, to green energy entities as up against fossil fuel industry? I think that's what's got to be looked at also is, where is that money to help support the development of these things? And that's, of course, a topic for another day, I think.
Right. But there might be hidden subsidies in fossil fuel in terms of lease sales and tax rebates and other things as well that we don't know about.
That should be separated out so that people can really see what the cost is to government and taxpayers for some of these things. South Central residents were asked again this week to reduce energy consumption. Because of the things that you were talking about, that we may face this winter with peak demand and not having storage capacity yet, I haven't heard anything about how well this did or did not go. Have you heard anything,
well,
Matthew?
The report is going to come out on Monday. I think they're doing a combination of polls with people saying, did you participate? Which, of course, it's the poll bias. Everybody's going to say, of course I did, because I want to chip in. Of course I support more money for... you're always going to do the right thing with an anonymous pollster on the phone. But they're also going to go to the energy company, see exactly what we did, if it was a blip or if it was a serious dent. I think last year we were under a 10% shift, under a 10% dip in usage at that time. I've heard anywhere from, it's always going to be single digits in terms of the people I've spoken to, the mayor or the energy companies. It's a good drill. It's good awareness. Let's hope that the brownouts and blackouts are not going to be reality down the line. But you always want to know if it goes from 6 to 8 and we wean ourselves off that power and that heat, I'd love to see the power surge from 8 to 8:30, where everybody opens up the fridge and cranks up the heat and totally undoes the progress that they made the previous 2 hours. But of course, we need to have it on our mind and the red, yellow, green code. Let's hope we don't have to really get down there and use it this winter. We had a warmer than usual one last season, so maybe we'll have.
And there is a plan in place now to meet this peak demand.
The legislature has done some work in this last session to encourage storage of gas, so that gas could be stored at times of low use. The other thing, there was some effort by some legislators to insist that any gas that's exported not be exported at this time, and that in fact that the flow be reversed from the Kenai LNG plant during these So use the Kenai LNG plant as a gas storage facility also.
How many? We're a couple of years away from the gas storage plant, though, being a reality. So maybe we can just keep it going for the years in between. Mm-hmm. And when you were saying not shipping gas out during these peak moments, I think that really has always rankled people, mm-hmm. where we're sending it to our gas to Asia at the same time that they're asking us to bundle up a little bit. But the plan is in place, and the legislature did take some action. We just have to get to that 2014 or that 2015.
Has it ever been stated what kind of energy savings the city is hoping to achieve by having people kind of turn off the television and shut off the lights in that two-hour window?
Well, there are, to use Don Rumsfeld's old saying about metrics for success, I think the mayor has stopped short of saying our goal is this. I think he just wants to encourage people. And then there's always the awkward possibility that if he sets the goal at 10% and we hit 6 or 7, then it's a quote-unquote failure. So I think that they're just trying to encourage people. We would like some hard and fast numbers in terms of a goal, but it's just an awareness campaign.
Well, if it actually comes to pass that you actually do have to, we're going to know because the power is going to go down or the mm-hmm. potentially or the gas is going to come off. So
that's right. So. Well, thank you, gentlemen. I was hoping that we could get to a discussion about the tobacco tax that's in front of the Anchorage Assembly, but we're running out of time. So thanks for joining me, and that will be a discussion for another Anchorage edition. Thank you for joining us, the folks that are out there. I want to thank Richard Maurer with the Anchorage Daily News and Matthew Felling with KTVA Channel 11. Don't forget, KAKM will be partnering with fellow public broadcasters to bring you Debate for the State, live statewide debates featuring candidates for U.S. House, U.S. Senate, and Governor, beginning next Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. If you'd like to ask a question, you can email it to questions@debateforthestate.org. Thanks for joining us.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.